Would you like to get involved with helping wildlife conservation? Well, we have some opportunities for you today. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry, who is on his way to give a presentation on his career public radio for the Science on Tap in Minocqua. It's a lecture series. If you're in the area, stop by. I'm sure he'd be happy to see you. So what that means is I get to talk to David Drake. And David is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. David stops by every other month, usually with Jamie Knack, but he's flying solo today. Thanks for coming in, David.
Well, thank you for having me by myself. I usually think I'm invited because Jamie's invited.
Well, that's probably the case, but, you know, we'll keep you too, okay? And David has some great opportunities to share with us for helping out wildlife. Are you a citizen scientist? Tell us about it. Or if you have a wildlife question or observation, we'd like to hear from you too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So, David, before we start, you know, there might be some people out there who don't quite know what a citizen scientist is. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, so we've talked about citizen science opportunities before. Snapshot Wisconsin is a great one right now that's going on, but there's deer reporting that goes on in the fall a lot of times and things like that. So citizen science is this growing idea, and it's been around for probably in the last two decades or so, but it's this growing idea of involving the public or just general members of the society, of the public, to report whatever they see out there in terms of natural resources. So there's if you go to inaturalist.org, which is a large citizen science online reporting portal, for example, you can create individual projects under that iNaturalist umbrella. And there's people who are created projects for astronomy, for minerals and rocks, for weather, for plants, animals, things like that. We obviously focus mostly on wildlife, and that's a very common and popular thing that seems to draw a lot of people's attention. So we are primarily focused on ways that citizens can get involved in reporting different species of wildlife or different wildlife events. And it's, as we've talked about again in the past, it is just an awesome opportunity for a whole host of reasons. Number one, it's a great opportunity, a great reason to get away from your computers or your your phones or tablets, right, and get outside, enjoy this great big outdoor world that we have. And it's just an awesome place to be in general. Breathe some fresh air, get some exercise. It's another way to also kind of involve the whole family. You know, you can go out as a family with your kids on a hike or go out specifically to do a citizen science event, whatever the case might be. So those, from the public standpoint, those are some of the benefits for the public. From the scientist standpoint, more and more scientists are using these databases that are being generated or populated by citizen reports. And for example, we have a iNaturalist page for our Fox and Coyote project, the UW Urban Canyon project, and we rely heavily on people's reports of fox and coyote here in the Madison area. A colleague of mine, Ben Zuckerberg, who's a climate change scientist, he does a lot with phenology, but also the Cornell Live of Ornithology eBird, where people across the country and to some extent across the world are reporting accounts of bird species. And then Ben is using that to look at historic range movements of these bird species relative to climate conditions and things like that. So it is a really, really valuable science database. And one of the wonderful things about citizen science is it is unbelievably cost effective. I mean, it's really expensive and sometimes very logistically difficult to collect all this data, regardless of being astronomy, plants, animals, whatever the case might be. But when you employ, you know, there's 325 million people in the United States. If you employ even a fraction of those people and they're reporting something following a protocol, it is a very cost efficient way to gather data.
Especially when budgets are being cut.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's always new things to do.
But you think, you think, you know, in the eastern half of the United States in particular is primarily privately owned. So accessing property to be able to actually observe and report accounts of wildlife or whatever the case might be is very difficult. So if you actually have people who have access to that property, it opens up a whole bunch of different areas that may have been previously inaccessible because of private property rights.
Right. We don't really think about that here in the Midwest. We do have a lot of more public land that we can see. But we did have a listener call in, and she couldn't stay on the line, but she said, I'm thinking it's a she, if not, I'm sorry. I've been a citizen scientist for the DNR monitoring Karner blue butterflies, and it's been such a fun and educational experience.
Yeah, so the Karner blue butterfly is an endangered species of butterfly. It's tightly tied to the plant called the lupine. And I did not report on that today because we typically don't think of insects as wildlife, but that is a big reporting project that the DNR has going on. And again, that's the Karner blue butterfly. If you've never seen them, the name is appropriate. It's a blue butterfly. It's just an absolutely beautiful azure blue.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you have lupine around you or near you, that is a good place to start looking for those butterflies.
And I'm impressed you know the color azure because...
I just looked it up today.
You just looked it up today. Okay. Well, you know, let's start talking about some opportunities to help right now. You know, I was out walking the Glacial Drummond Trail this weekend, and I found a painted turtle, and I thought, oh, some bike is going to hit that. So I picked it up and put it across. Was that a good thing for me to do, or should I just have left it?
Well, generally, moving turtles off of roadways is a good thing to do.
Okay.
However, and if there are people from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation listening, I'm sure they're going to want me to say this, make sure you do it in a safe manner because, you know, there are people who, with the best of intentions, they will stop on a highway to move turtles off the road. And that is not only dangerous for the person trying to move the turtle, it's dangerous for the motorists and things like that. So sometimes, you know, obviously use good judgment and common sense. But if you have the ability to safe for you, safe for the turtle, safe for motorists, to move turtles across roads, you should do that. And as typically we say, you should, whichever direction the head is, you should move them that direction, continue to move them that direction. But right now, May through July is the primary breeding season or nesting season for turtles. And so turtles, obviously, are most of the turtles, we have 11 turtle species in the state of Wisconsin. Most of them are tightly tied to water or wetland complexes. The ornate box turtle and the wood turtle are the two that are not as tied to the water as the other nine species. But regardless, all these turtles can move. They don't have to just stay in the water. And most of the time, they will seek out some kind of a sandy or gravelly type area to lay their eggs. They'll dig a hole in that substrate with their back legs, deposit the eggs, cover the hole back up, and then they leave. And then the turtle eggs incubate in the soil, the temperature of the soil, for 60 to 90 days. They'll hatch out, and then they're really on their own. So right now we're seeing a lot of turtles moving across roadways because they're moving from a wetland area to someplace where they can nest. And most of the time, a lot of the roads we have in Wisconsin have gravel shoulders, and that's a really good place for them to nest. It's prime nesting habitat. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're moving so much across the roads right now. And if you do have the ability to help them across the road safely, you should do that.
We have a whole bunch of people on our Facebook page that were, you know, telling stories about how they've got turtles across the road. And, you know, sometimes they find one that's been hit and, you know, bring them to rehab, which is wonderful if they can save them. I don't know if that's possible, but a lot of them are snappers. And what is a safe way? Because snapping turtles are dangerous.
Yes, well... But danger is a relative term, I guess.
Well,
but snapping turtles, you know, a number of the turtles, well, every turtle can bite, but there are a couple of the turtle species. Snapping turtles, for example, soft-shell turtles have a pretty pretty nasty, you know, painful bite. But snapping turtles are deceptively fast, especially in the head area. So you, for one thing, if you can avoid touching the snapping turtle and you can move it across the road by just kind of gently pushing it off on the back tail end of the shell with your foot, or get a stick and move it, you know, kind of prod it along the road. And just if you can avoid putting your hands on the turtle, that's probably the best thing for you. And a lot of people pick snapping turtles up by either the rear legs or the tail, because that's the furthest point away from that head and the mouth. But especially those turtles, the heavier they are, that is not a good thing for the turtle. It's not, it can dislocate the legs and it's not good for the tail and things like that. So, if you have to pick the turtle up, the best thing to do is to put one hand on the top of the shell right behind the head and one hand on the top of the shell right in front of the tail and lift the animal up that way. Some people do pick it up by the side of the shell, but the back legs are constantly moving and you can get scratched that way. So there's an infection possibility there. But if you can avoid touching, especially snapping turtles and moving them off the road, that would be the best.
Okay.
And then the DNR's got a Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program. That's one of the citizen science opportunities that we'd like to talk about today. And the DNR is asking for anybody who sees turtles on roadways in particular, if they would go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And then once you're on that site on their search engine, just type in Wisconsin Turtle Conservation Program, and you can report the sighting of the turtle. And what they're trying to do is collect all these turtle sightings to identify hot spots where turtles are primarily crossing roads. And then they can try to mitigate turtles getting hit by cars on these roads. So one of the things that they're doing is working with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation and putting culverts under the roadway where possible and trying to get these turtles to move under the roadway through the culverts instead of across the road surface. So that's kind of a neat thing. And then the other thing that's come about from this turtle conservation program, the citizen science opportunity, is the DNR has actually been able to locate some populations of turtles that are having trouble from a conservation standpoint. So like the wood turtle and the Blandin's turtle, where they normally weren't aware that these turtle populations were there. But since people are reporting them, now all of a sudden they're seeing greater coverage across the state, which is a good thing.
Yeah, and that's the Blandin's in particular, isn't it? That's the one that has really had a lot of trouble with being hit.
Yeah, the Blandin's turtle is one of them. That turtle is associated with kind of slow-moving wetland areas, a lot of duckweed on the water and things like that. And they do get hit quite a bit, and they're of a conservation concern right now. So
okay.
The fact that they're getting hit is not good for the overall population status.
Right. And as far as identifying them, is there a good place to go?
To
identify what turtle you're looking at?
Well, the DNR, in conjunction with the Wisconsin University of Wisconsin Extension, put together a series of three publications on reptiles and amphibians. And one is Turtles and Lizards of Wisconsin.
Okay.
And you can order that through the DNR's website. But I think also if you were just to go into Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and type in their search engine Wisconsin Turtles,
you'd get some pictures and information. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Great. Well, let's go to the phones. And we do have room for your phone call too. So if you have a question or a sighting you'd like to share with us, call at 1-800-642-1234. And first up, we have Larry in Madison. Hi, Larry.
Hi, good morning. First, I wanted to share that last week I participated in a spring fawn count that was headed up by the DNR. I know they, always need more volunteers for those kinds of things. However, I believe this was the last week of the spring fawn count. I know their goal was to find and measure and put radio collars on 100 fawns, and I understand that they did meet their goal on that. But it was a really fun event. I mean, there was some exertion. We did a lot of sweating. But, and we found one fawn, and we saw several adult deer along the way also, but it was a very interesting experience and rewarding. And then I also wanted to share, I'm currently driving through Madison right now, and I just saw a very healthy-looking coyote right near the intersection of Mineral Point Road and Whitney Way. It looked like it wanted to cross Whitney Way until one of the other drivers honked at it, and then it turned and went back.
Wow.
That's pretty neat, Larry. Well, if you don't mind, that is a coyote that we are studying. That's the coyote's pack that lives in Owen Park, O-W-E-N Park, on the west side of Madison, if you're familiar with that area. But if you would go to our iNaturalist page, just pull up iNaturalist.org, and then under projects, search UW Urban Canid Project. And if you'd report it through our page, I'd really appreciate that. The other thing about the spring fawn count, was that out in Iowa County?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's a big five-year DNR project that they've got going on to look at CWD impacts on deer. They're also radio collaring coyotes and bobcats out there to look at predator impact on especially fawn survival. But the way they find the fawns, this is kind of an interesting thing. So in the fall, they will trap the female does. They'll trap them with a drop net, and then they'll put a radio collar on them. But they also will implant what's called a vaginal implant transmitter, or a VIT, V-I-T, in the fall. So when the female gets bred during the fall breeding season, when she's pregnant and the fawn is born, the fawn will push that vit out, and then they will go with radio receiver, and they'll look for the vit during fawn breeding, fawn drop. And the fawns don't move too far from that vit. And that's why they need all these people, is because they know where the vit is, but they don't exactly know where the fawn is. And so they'll have these people, and they just line them up almost shoulder to shoulder, and they just walk in mass across the landscape until they either kick the fawn. I don't say mean to kick the fawn up, but they startle the fawn, and the fawn will run. Or they'll come across the fawn, and obviously fawns are spotted and relatively scentless for the first couple weeks of their life. And so they try to blend in. So sometimes the fawns will just try to hide and allow you to kind of walk over them, and you then catch them with your hands. It's kind of a neat experience. And I know the DNR involves a lot of the public, and it's just an awesome opportunity to go see deer up close.
That is amazing. Yeah. I love that. Well, you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking about wildlife with David Drake, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Do you have a question or a comment? Please give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Right now, we're talking about wildlife with David Drake. David, we did have a caller, a listener who called in but couldn't stay on to say, ask if you can clarify if it's okay to pick up a turtle by the tail because they've heard it's fatal.
It's not fatal. It won't kill the animal, but again, the heavier the animal is. So, you know, the largest turtles we have in the state are snapping turtles, and they can get,
huge.
Huge, yeah, I mean, relatively speaking. And it's just not good for the animal to pick them up by the tail. You can dislocate the tail and it causes some other problems. So it's best if you don't pick them up by the tail.
Okay, we got that clarified now. So to kind of go on a little bit, we want to talk about collecting data on frogs and toads. How can we do that?
Yeah, this is another long-standing citizen science project, and I think it's been going on since 1984. So the DNR conducts a Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey. We have 12 frogs and toads in the state of Wisconsin. So 11 frogs, one toad species. just one toad. And just like with birds, so for example...
What do I hear? I hear frogs, right?
That would be a toad, the trill of the toad.
Was that a toad?
Yeah.
What do I know?
Well, it's close. You know, they're all related, so same thing. But so just like with birds, so for example, a cardinal will call purdy, 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 or something, or, you know, you can get a black and white warbler that sounds like a squeaky wheelbarrow wheel, for example. Each frog species and that one toad species, they have a call unique to the species. So wood frogs, for example, people describe it as a quacking duck. Mm-hmm. Spring peepers is peep, 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 peep. You know, the toad is that long trill. And so what they will do... the DNR has established about 100 routes throughout the state, 100 transect routes, and they will recruit people to go out, and they'll train you how to do this, and they'll have people go out and run the route or drive the route and stop at known points along the way, and then they'll have you listen for 5 to 10 minutes and hear, see what you hear. And so this is what's called an index. So you'll either put down a number 1, a number 2, or a number 3. So if you put down a number 1... you hear, you can hear individual frogs or individual toads calling. So you'll hear a call, and then there'll be a brief pause. You'll hear another call. If you put down a number 2, you'll hear multiple calls, and they kind of will run over the top of each other, but not overwhelmingly. And if you hear number 3, it's hard to distinguish individuals. So that is kind of an index as to the abundance of how many toads and frogs are in each area. And the nice thing about these frog and toad surveys going on since 1984 is that it provides an index over time about how well these species are doing at each location. So you can kind of monitor the health of the population, which is a good thing. And frogs and toads, being amphibians, that they need water and they need an upland area. They need water for breeding and for the summer, and they go to an upland area typically, some of them will go to an upland area for hibernation. Mm-hmm. Some stay in the water for hibernation, just burrow into the mud. But because they're so closely associated and their bodies are always in the water, they're really susceptible to pollutants. So if you have non-point source pollutants running off, or you have toxins in the soil or the water, they absorb that into their body, and they're very susceptible. And because of that, and because of loss of wetlands and the habitat, that some of the frog and toad species just aren't doing as well as we'd like them to be doing.
And if somebody wants to get involved in that, where would they go?
Yeah, the best thing, again, is you could just Google Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey, and it should bring you right to that page. And then there's ways, there's a number of menus across the top of the page that you can drop down, and you can see how you can get involved with some of that. So typically with frogs and toads, there are three distinct breeding seasons. So we have an early breeding season, a middle breeding season, a late breeding season. The first two breeding seasons have been completed already. So your next opportunity would be the beginning of July through, I think, first two or three weeks of July. And that's when you would go out to actually monitor what we call the true frog species, like the bullfrog, mink frog, green frog, and things like that. So that's your next and last opportunity to take part in the Wisconsin Frog and Toad Survey for this year.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones now. We have John in Delafield, who I think has a question about frogs. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, this is an amphibian question. Down near Southern Kettle Marine, Lapham Peak area, I used to take a lot of walks along the rural highways there, and probably the mid to late 90s, I would just find tremendous number of frogs. Unfortunately, they would not make it across the small roads there. And later in the 90s, and probably maybe right around the millennium, I noticed a dramatic decrease. And it was almost like a year later or 2 years later, I didn't see any frogs anymore. And I was really concerned because I didn't know if the climate factors had an influence. But you just talked about wetlands and having some pollution. Are there any indications of loss of habitat is always a possibility, but it was just a major shift from seeing so many frogs 1 year to the next frog. Do those populations fluctuate from year to year, or is it pretty much a longer term trend of amphibians?
Yeah, John, that's a good question and a good observation. It's always difficult when people call in, and I get this question a lot off the radio as well. You know, I used to see so many of these. I don't see any of them now. And, you know, there's so many possible explanations for that. I mean, one is we're just perhaps not out at the same time of the day or night that we were last year. You know, maybe there was just a flux of birds that came through, for example, and we were just lucky enough to hit that. There's changing landscape variables, you know, changing food availability, abundance. There might be more predators this year than there were last year. There might also be some other issues going on, like maybe there's a disease outbreak or something of that nature. So it's really difficult to say without some prior baseline knowledge and some additional study to say, well, there really is a decline in the frog population where you are without knowing more. But, you know, there is, in addition to habitat loss, in addition to habitat degradation, roads, killing the frogs, things like that, there is a virus out there now called the rhinovirus that is also starting to have a bit of an impact on frog and salamander populations in the state of Wisconsin. So there could be a variety of possibilities as to why you're not seeing as many frogs. It also could be that frog population, where you are in a larger regional context, is just fine. They're just in a different spot than where you're used to seeing them.
Okay. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Tim in Wood County. Hi, Tim.
Hello there.
What's your question or comment?
Thanks for the taking my call. Yeah, I was going to talk about a deer and a couple of birds that were interacting in the yard, but you're talking about frogs, and I had an observation a couple of years ago. I was walking down to the lake shore, and I saw a chipmunk that was sitting on a pile of old dock sections off of the edge of the woods, and he was definitely eating something, and I approached it, and it kind of turned, and here it had a leopard frog by its hind leg. And it was chewing the webbing off of the hind leg of this leopard frog. And the leopard frog was just dangling, and every once in a while it'd kick its other leg. And as it ate this fin, it kind of rotated the leg around, and now the belly of the frog was facing me, and its front legs were just stubs. The fins were gone on that as well. And I was
can I say you? Can I say you?
Idea about chipmunks and how they don't just eat nuts and berries and they must have hunted that frog down.
Yeah.
My observation is that typical of a chipmunk hunting frogs, and would that frog regenerate the fins?
Well, it is not typical, and I don't know if you've ever had frog legs, but they're not too bad, so it's not typical of a chipmunk, but obviously that chipmunk's got a pretty cultured palate. So, and in terms of regenerating, it's unlikely. There are some reptiles, some amphibians that will regenerate. Some of the salamanders, for example, will, but I don't believe the leopard frog will. I could be wrong on that, but my recollection is that they typically don't. And it is not common. Chipmunks, as you mentioned, are primarily herbivores or vegetarian, so it's not common for them to do that. But at the same time, animals do things that are not always common, and hunger and food is a big motivator for a lot of animals. So who knows why the chipmunk took the opportunity to do that with the frog, but obviously it found something appetizing about that frog.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, I think, Tim. I appreciate that. Let's go to Susan in Janesville. Hi, Susan. What's your question?
Hi, I had a question about the collars on the fawns, and I was wondering, what is the purpose of the collars, and do they outgrow them eventually? Then what happens?
Yeah, those are good questions, Susan. So the purpose of the collar, again, that study going on in Iowa County, one of the objectives is to look at fawn survival. So the purpose of the collar is to see how long that fawn lives. Does it make it into adulthood? If it does, how long does it live as an adult? Where does it go? When it dies, can they determine what caused the death of that fawn? And in particular, they're looking at CWD, for example. They're looking at a couple of different predators, again, the coyote and the bobcat. So those are the purposes of putting the collar on the fawn. And I am not aware of the specific type of collar they're using on the fawn, but typically what they would do when you put a collar on a young animal is you allow for the growth of that collar. So a lot of times what they'll do is they will sew a piece of flexible fabric like neoprene or some kind of an elastic fabric into that collar. So as the animal grows, the collar could expand without causing any problem to the neck of that animal.
Okay, good to know. Thanks for asking about that, Susan. We're talking about wildlife today with David Drake. What questions do you have, or comments or observations? Why don't you share those with us? Our number is 1-800-642-1234, and we do have open lines. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Next up, we have Mark in Dodgeville. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I've been a citizen scientist without knowing it for many years. I'm a forester in southwest Wisconsin, and I've reported perhaps 100 new locations of rare plants and a few cases of animals to the Bureau of Endangered Resources.
Oh, that's great.
Now.
Thank you.
I also just came from the Erickson Wetland down at Argyle. It's a 220-acre property owned by our local land trust, the Driftless Area Land Conservancy. We have blandings. We believe we have blanchard cricket frogs. We have a few other listed rare species. And we've been working with our property for a number of years on restoration. My question is about a large transmission line being proposed through the southwest part of the state. It's going to come from Iowa through Montfort to Middleton. It's going to have towers about 150 feet tall. It's going to be about 125 feet wide of cleared forest or whatever else they come to. And I wonder what kind of effect that's going to have on wildlife throughout this area.
Yeah, that's a good question. And obviously, I know American Transmission Company, for example, ATC, has been putting up a lot of these high tower lines around Madison and around the state. And it's always a kind of a difficult issue because I know for one that I don't necessarily think they're all that attractive on the landscape. There is some minor habitat destruction going on. I know that ATC does, and other companies like them, they do try to put these lines through areas that are going to have the least impact on the environment. And I think generally these companies are pretty environmentally sensitive and aware and are trying to do the best thing that they can. At the same time, every time I want to turn the light on, I'm really happy the light comes on in my house. Or if I want to sit down and watch a football game on TV, I'm glad the TV comes on. So, you know, we're kind of in this no-win situation where we need the electricity, but at the same time, those lines have to go somewhere. So I'm assuming, and I don't know the specifics of the particular line you're talking about, Mark, but I'm assuming that these lines and the company putting them up also has to go through the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin. And the Public Service Commission of Wisconsin is a regulatory authority that kind of helps to make sure that everything is done according to law and regulation in Wisconsin. They have very strict environmental regulations, so they have to go through essentially an environmental assessment, if you will. And there's also a lot of monitoring and assessment going on as these lines are being erected. So, and there's different impacts. So when they actually build the lines or build these towers, put the towers up, there's a short-term immediate impact on the very local footprint of that tower, and then driving the vehicles, the heavy equipment vehicles they need to get the towers erected. There is a short-term impact on the immediate habitat where that is all occurring. But once the line gets erected, the tower gets built, and all the equipment is removed, a lot of times they restore that back to the type of habitat that was there prior to the line going in. In terms of once the line is up, there are some issues or some concerns about primarily flying wildlife. So that would be mostly birds. But most of the literature on transmission lines and birds has indicated that a lot of times even migratory birds are able to avoid these lines. And if you are in the Madison area where the ATC line went up across across Lake Wabisa and things like that, if you look on these lines, you'll see these spiral-type devices on the line, and those are put on in order to help illuminate the line or make it more visible for birds to see so they can avoid it easier. And I think generally that these lines have generally a pretty low impact on wildlife overall.
Okay, great. Thanks for bringing that up, Mark. We appreciate that. Let's go next to Peggy and Monona. Hi, Peggy.
Hi.
What do you have for us today?
Well, we have some property in Iowa County that has a small pond, about a half an acre. And 2 weeks ago, when we were out, we saw a female common merganser with seven adorable little, I don't know if you call baby ducks chicks or not, and they would pop up and down in the water eating, and we had fun watching them for 3 days. And then when we went out last week, they were all gone. And I was just wondering what could have happened to them. I don't think the babies were old enough to fledge yet. Do you have any ideas?
Yeah, so those that's not an uncommon story. So we have three different species of mergansers in the state of Wisconsin. Those are diving ducks. We have the hooded merganser, which has this, they're kind of a more primarily a black bird with white hood or sail. Common mergansers, which you're talking about, and red-breasted mergansers. And a lot of times when ducks have young, there's a lot of animals that eat those young. So muskie will eat them, for example. Turtles will come up from under the water and grab them. But you also have aerial predators. So you have a host of birds. If they're on land or near land, you might get mink that will get them. You might get, you know, feral cats or something like that. So, and one of the reasons that they have so many young is because not all of them survive. And the idea from a reproductive strategy is let's have as many young as we can with the hope that at least some of them will survive.
So life's not easy for ducklings.
Life is not easy for ducklings.
Thanks so much, Peggy. Next up is Rosemary, and she's in Racine by Wind Lake. Hi, Rosemary.
Oh, this is absolutely wonderful that I actually get to ask this question. 40 years ago, coming out to the car, have lived on Wind Lake for the last 40 years, and came across a snake that had its fangs in the back of a toad. So, of course, I took my shoe off and I'm beating the snake, and, you know, definitively there was fangs. Toad hopped away. Snake slithered away. Snake was kind of like just a muted, like, light brown color. I had heard that we have water moccasins on Wind Lake. What's the possibility of that?
Well, if it was truly a toad, Rosemary, so one of the things about toads, if you're familiar with toads, they have all these bumps all over them. But toads excrete this really vile substance. And so if you ever have seen a dog catch a toad in its mouth, that dog quickly drops that toad because the toad will start excreting the substance as a defense mechanism to have whatever it has the toad in its mouth to spit it out. And so that happens with no matter what's trying to eat it, and that might have been what's happening with that snake. Over in Racine County, we only have two venomous species of snake in Wisconsin. One is the Massasauga rattlesnake, and the other is the timber rattlesnake. And neither one of those species, the range does not extend into Racine that I'm aware of. And we do not have water moccasins. Water moccasin is a venomous type of water snake. Water moccasins do not extend this far north. But a lot of people say, well, if they see a snake in the water, it's got to be a water moccasin. We do have a northern water snake, and water snakes, the northern water snake is a rather aggressive snake. It's non-venomous, but it will charge at people occasionally. It is commonly in the water. A lot of other snake species will be in the water. They are able to swim if they want to or need to. But I guarantee you it was not a water moccasin, so do not be worried about that. And every snake species has teeth. That's how they capture their food. So, the only species that have fangs, true fangs, are the venomous, the two rattlesnakes. So I'm not sure what kind of a snake you had over there. I'm sure it had teeth. I'm not sure it had fangs necessarily, but that's maybe another story for another day.
There you go. Okay, Rosemary, thank you for sharing that with us. Next up is Hallie in Deerfield. Hi, Hallie.
Hi.
What's your question?
I actually have a question about tiger salamanders. Last fall, we found two in our window well, and they were in very rough shape. This is kind of the first frost, so we ended up taking them in and setting up a little habitat for them, and we've been feeding them all winter, and they have tripled in size. But my question is, I have reached out to a couple people about releasing them, and mostly they say I should not do that. And I guess I'm wondering what your opinion is. I wasn't planning on keeping them forever, but maybe I'm not allowed to.
Yeah. Well, Hallie, thank you very much. And tiger salamanders are one of the, I think we've got seven salamander species in the state of Wisconsin, something like that. Tiger salamanders are a blackish bodied species. They have yellow spots on them. Super cool animals. All the salamanders, essentially, they need that wetland to upland habitat too. And so what's happened in the spring and summer, they'll go into the wetland to breed, lay eggs, live. And then in the fall, they go to the upland and they burrow into loose soil or under the detritus, and that's where they hibernate. So a lot of times, if you have open window wells, the salamanders will fall into those. And so not only you, Hallie, but anybody else, if you have open window wells, put some kind of a plywood cover, or you can buy covers at the hardware store. Put a cover over your window well, and that will avoid young skunks, salamanders, frogs, all sorts of things falling into your window well. You don't have to worry about that. All right. So thank you for taking them in. Legally, anytime you have a free-ranging species of wildlife, if you're going to take them into your house or hold them for more than 12 hours or so, you legally need a permit to do so from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. So, Hallie, I'm not going to report you this time, but just for anybody else, I know, and people have the best of intentions. That's why they bring these animals in, and because they want to take care of the animal. I get that for sure, but just legally, you need a permit to do that. But Hallie, if you want to release those two species or those two salamanders, please do so. They should be just fine. And what I would do is take them to the nearest wetland, the wetland nearest to you, because that's probably where they came from last fall. Take them down to the water's edge, release them into, if you have tall grass or some vegetation, and they will be just fine. And if you cover the window wells, they won't be back there next fall.
Okay, thanks, Hallie, for bringing that up. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking about wildlife with David Drake. He's a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. Do you have a question or comment? Give us a call. We have some open lines, 1-800-642-1234, and you can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. Well, it's Wednesday, so we're talking about wildlife today on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau sitting in for Larry. David Drake is our guest. And David, we've been talking about opportunities to be a citizen scientist. And one of the ones that's been around for a while, and we've talked about here, is the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Why don't you remind us what that is?
Yeah, so this is the second go-round of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. It's a five-year survey of breeding birds. So these are birds that are here in the state of Wisconsin during the spring and summer, and actually are breeding. That's why they call it the Breeding Bird Atlas.
Great name.
And so it's a hugely logistically complicated, very labor-intensive project where they are not only the DNR, but we have just some phenomenal birders in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
I mean, people who are very passionate, you know, real experts on bird identification by song and sight. And then we've got people who may not be all that familiar with birds, but just are really interested in it. And so it's an opportunity for people to statewide to go and help collect information on breeding birds. And this allows the DNR and management agencies, regulatory agencies, to get a sense about how abundant are some of these species, where are they located, are the ranges shifting, and things like that. And so the Breeding Bird Atlas, I think they're in their third year, I want to say, but I could be wrong about
that. I was going to ask
you.
I think you're right.
I think it's the third of the fifth year. And so if you just Google Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, you'll find information on it. You can go to the DNR page and find it through their search engine as well by just typing in Breeding Bird Atlas. It's the second Breeding Bird Atlas going on. So, and it's just an opportunity for people to get involved, and they need people to go out all across the state, and they've got a specific protocol. They'll train you how to do it. And if you're not familiar with birds, they'll try to pair you up with somebody who's more comfortable and confident in bird identification or more of an expert, or you can tag along with some of the DNR biologists and get some experience and things like that. But it is an awesome example of, you know, ways to collect data. And so some of the rare birds that they spotted this past week included the Hudsonian godwit.
Let's hear what that sounds like, David. Excellent.
So the Hudsonian godwit, the snowy egret.
Okay, snowy egret.
Yeah. The glossy ibis and several white-faced ibises at Horicon Marsh.
Okay, glossy first. And what does the white face sound like, Dave? I couldn't tell the difference. But.
So godwits, egrets, and ibises are all wading birds. So
okay.
You find them, they're tall-legged birds, various shapes and lengths of bills, depending on what they're eating and where along that water depth they're feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And just super cool birds. So if you want to see them, it's great to have binoculars. A spotting scope sometimes is helpful. And you would go out to wetland areas, and you can typically you see these birds more than you hear these birds. Rails are another type of wetland or wading type bird. They're super secretive, so you're much more common to hear them than you are to see them. But
okay.
Like the egrets in particular, they're this just large white bird with black legs, and
mm-hmm.
they're beautiful birds. Yeah, they're pretty neat to mm-hmm. see. And then, so in addition to those birds, they saw lark bunting and portage.
Lark bunting. Oh, pretty.
Yeah, so the bunties are super cool.
Mm-hmm. What else?
Yeah. A lingering snowy owl in Oconto.
Okay, we don't have snowy owl right now, but sorry.
Well, apparently they had one last week. So
we don't have a sound effect.
A sound
for
one,
snowy
yeah.
Owl, so.
And snowy owls obviously are that white owl. They're typically out more during the day than most owls are, and we're more common to see them in the winter when they push down from Canada into our state.
Shouldn't they be gone by now?
They should be, yeah. So this one, I don't know if he's just loitering or
what
he's doing.
Badger fan.
A badger fan,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
And then they had a white owl, or I'm sorry, a white-eyed vireo.
White-eyed. Okay.
Okay. And then in Sauk, they had seven Bell's vireos.
Excellent.
And we have a number of vireo species in the state, red-eyed vireo, Bell's, white-eyed vireo. And vireos are a forested bird, typically associated with more contiguous interior forest land. They have a hook on the end of their top bill. And just neat birds.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, and thanks, Dave Potras, for getting those up for us. That was awesome. And speaking of birds, let's go to George. He's been waiting, and he's from Chippewa County. Hi, George.
Good morning. Well, I have a question, but first of all, a comment. I live on the southern part of Chippewa County, so we're just not too far from the Eau Claire County line. About 2 weeks ago, I'm a biker and a walker. About 2 weeks ago, I saw a male bobolink in a hay meadow, and it's been at least 40 or 50 years since I've seen one of those. The last 2 years, I've randomly seen a couple meadowlarks, and my question is, are these actually reestablishing themselves?
George, that's a good question. So both bobolinks, bobolink is kind of a, I don't know, maybe the size of, not quite the size of a robin, a little bit smaller, primarily a darker or blackish bird with a yellow kind of back to, yellowish part to the back of its head. And then meadowlarks are kind of a they've got just beautiful yellow chest, kind of a blackish, whitish type modeling across the back. Both of those birds are what we would call obligate grassland birds, or they're associated with grasslands, meadows, hay fields like you're describing. And so both of those birds are I haven't seen the data on this for a number of years, but I think that both of those birds are coming back in terms of population numbers. And they don't seem to. We have other bird species that are associated with grasslands, like upland sandpipers and some of the sparrow species that seem to be a little bit more susceptible to disturbance in these grasslands. My recollection is that bobolinks and meadowlarks are not as susceptible to disturbance, and so they are able to kind of associate or inhabit grasslands that where you might have a little bit more woody vegetation encroachment, or you might have some other things going on that might drive some of the other more susceptible grassland birds out of that area. But the bobolinks in particular seem to be, I think, coming back a little bit more than some of the other grassland birds. But there is also a lot of focus on grassland birds in general in terms of trying to provide grassland habitat, prairie habitat. But there's also been a very large push in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so to work with farmers to not cut some of these hay fields before July 15th so that these grassland birds can actually get at least one nest off successfully, where the birds, the eggs hatch out and the birds fledge before the hay gets cut. And so I think a lot of the farmers are abiding by that July 15th cut date. And that is, I think, also helping some of these grassland populations a little bit.
Well, that's good news, because I know we've had a lot of people call in and say, hey, I haven't seen meadowlarks or bobolinks for so long. So that's really good news.
Yeah, it's neat. And, you know, the meadowlarks in particular are just such neat birds to see. And they've got that beautiful call of spring of the year.
No singing. Thanks, George. We really appreciate that. Next up, we have Paul in Ashland. Hi, Paul. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As I said, I live in Ashland, Wisconsin, actually on the Ashland-Bayfield County border, Ashland County-Bayfield County border. And the wolf population, obviously there's a lot of political issues surrounding the wolf population and controlling it. But I've had close encounters with some wolves up in this area, but also in central Wisconsin. And I just kind of wondering what your take is on the wolf population, controlling it, and what effect that has had on other things. I'm a turkey hunter, and I've noticed in an area in central Wisconsin that when I noticed a lot of wolf presence, in fact, I had a close encounter with one, the population of the turkey seemed to go down. Now, that might have been just a cyclic issue, but it's my observation. Anyway, I'm just wondering what your take on that would be.
Yeah, Paul, that's a good question. I have not paid all that close attention to the wolf population in the state of Wisconsin. So the one thing I know is it is increasing, because they have not had a harvest season because the wolves are back on the endangered species list. So,
well, actually, David, wasn't there something in the news this morning about the population of wolves actually going down a little bit in the last survey?
Well, you know what? If there is, I haven't seen that.
Okay, so I believe we could be right. That this morning.
Yep.
It wasn't a huge amount,
no,
but it did go down.
You could be right.
A bit,
and like I said, I have not been paying close attention to the wolf situation in Wisconsin. So I don't know necessarily about that. But generally, generally the wolf population is healthy. I will say that, whether it's gone down a little bit or gone up a little bit, it is healthy for a variety of reasons, but primarily because they have not had a harvest season for the last couple of years since they've been put back on the endangered species list. Typically, I would not suspect that the wolf population would have any impact on the turkey population because typically turkey is not a staple of the wolf diet. And turkeys also nest on the ground, so the eggs are susceptible to a lot of different animals. But, wolves, I suspect they might eat a turkey if they have the opportunity to, or a turkey egg if they have the opportunity to. But they're not targeting turkeys. They're not targeting turkey nests. A lot of times with turkey populations, if you have an increase in raccoons or skunks or something like that, which are predators of turkey nests, sometimes that can drive down the turkey population a little bit as well.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling and asking about the wolves, Paul. We appreciate your call. And we're talking about wildlife today with David Drake. And David, before we go out for news real quick, I hear noise. So I think we're going to be going out. We're going to be going out. Sorry about that. We're talking about wildlife again with UW Extension Wildlife Specialist David Drake. Do you have a question? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And of course, you can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We have lots of stories about turtles, but we would like to see stories about some other wildlife too, maybe some birds you've seen or pictures of wildlife in your backyard. And of course, we'll be right back after this news update from NPR and WPR. So stay with us. There's more to come. Hi, I'm Jill Najo, filling in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. Wildlife expert David Drake is back with us. He is a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. And we're talking about all types of wildlife today. What questions do you have? Join the conversation. We have a couple of lines open. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And David, before we get to phone calls and emails, you want to talk a little bit about what's going on with the white nose syndrome for bats. It's just been horrible in the state.
Unfortunately, the news just continues to be bad.
It is.
The DNR just put out some information in a press release on this. They completed their winter cave surveys, obviously, over the wintertime, and all 60 of the sites they visited in 2018 had infected bats in them with white nose syndrome. And I guess we should remind the listeners what white nose syndrome is.
Yes.
It's a fungus that occurs in mine and cave systems where bats go to hibernate for the winter. We've got a number of bat species in the state of Wisconsin, four of which stay here year-round. And because they're here year-round, in the wintertime, obviously, bats are insect eaters. The food source is not available. They're not equipped physiologically to keep themselves warm on top of that, so they will go into a mine or a cave or other places to hibernate. And there is a fungus that's occurring in these mining cave systems that will get on the bat, and the reason it's called white nose syndrome is because it starts on their nose or the face, and then it will start migrating out to the wings, and it will eat holes in the wings, for example. But this fungus also seems to cause the bats to wake up during hibernation, and bats are true hibernators, so they go into what's called torpor. In order for them to go from true hibernation to being active again, they have to burn a lot of energy to get their metabolism up to speed where they can become active. So they're not only burning a lot of energy and a lot of valuable fat resources they need to make it through the hibernation period, but they also are disoriented. They will die of hypothermia because they'll fly out of the cave because they're disoriented out into the winter weather. They die of dehydration, starvation, and hypothermia. And so it is a really insidious disease. And although the DNR and the United States Geological Survey, the National Wildlife Health Lab, and others at universities across the country are looking at ways to mitigate this. They're starting to try to look at vaccines for the bats. They're looking at ultraviolet light to try to eradicate the fungus in the cave systems. Nothing yet seems to be working where it's effective range-wide. So, unfortunately, it is still causing a lot of problems amongst the bat species that hibernate, not only in the state of Wisconsin, but anywhere in the country. And I think right now it's affected 39 different states, or it's been found in 39 different states. But so,
and Canada, too. I know it's up in Canada.
And Canada.
Yeah.
So all 60 of the sites that were visited in the winter of 2017-18 were infected. The very first site that they ever found, 99% of the bats in that cave have now died. So they've seen a 99% decrease in bat population in that cave. And as it seems that as the white-nose syndrome, or that fungus, the longer that fungus is in the cave, the greater the decrease in the bat population. So some caves have seen 85% drops in their third year of infection, for example, and things like that. And 25 of the 28 counties with known bat hibernacula, or bat where bats hibernate, now have white-nose syndrome or the fungus that causes it. So that's a really bad thing. And the fear is now that they're starting to see what they think as a result of this is declines in summer bat populations or summer bat roosts. And say they've seen declines up to 80% in some places of the
wow.
state. So, yeah, it is a real shame. And as they're working very hard to try to solve this problem. As I mentioned, there's research going on to look at vaccines for white nose syndrome, ultraviolet light, ways to eradicate the fungus in the cave system, and things like that. So if people want to get involved, a couple of things you could do, you put up some bat houses around your residence or on your property, or you could also go and donate to the Wisconsin DNR Bat Conservation Program. You can also, that's another citizen science opportunity is monitoring bats out during the summer. The DNR will teach you how to do that. But if you want more information on white nose syndrome, you can just Google white nose syndrome. Or if you want more information on this specifically to Wisconsin, go to the DNR page and then bat conservation.
Okay, great. Thank you for that information, David. Not happy news, but hopefully
yeah.
something will happen soon.
Yeah, hopefully.
Before we go to the phones, we did get an email from Kevin in Blue Mounds, and he says, we just found a pair of badgers in the pasture next to our property, and he hears that they are aggressive. Also, that they move around a lot. we saw the pair once last weekend, and they have not been seen since. Could they have moved on? Do you know how far they range? Apparently, they're worried about their dogs meeting them in the yard. So what's the scoop on badgers?
Yeah, well, obviously, badgers, we are the badger state, but we're not named because of badger,
we're
the
not.
Animal.
No.
This is the interesting part. We are named because of the lead miners back in the 1800s that they would dig into the sides of hillsides looking for lead, and they were called badgers. So
yes.
that's why we're named the Badger State, is because the lead miner is not necessarily the
so
animal.
So it shouldn't be Bucky Badger. It should be Bucky Miner.
Maybe. Right? That's right. Who knows? Maybe you can start a campaign, Jill.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so badgers, they are a protected species in the state of Wisconsin. A colleague of mine, Tim Van Dielen, tried to find out more about this species in conjunction with the DNR, where they tried to put collars on these animals or radios and see what was going on. And they just had a hard time of keeping the collars on the animal, for one thing. But the other thing is these animals live most of their life underground, and it's hard to get a signal when they're under the ground. So they weren't able to get all that much information on in terms of longevity of these animals, how many there might be, things like that. The best thing I can say is badgers, just like any animal, can be aggressive if they're cornered. I think the badger has a bit of a bad reputation. I'm not sure. They can be a mean, aggressive animal, but I don't think they're not going to necessarily charge you just because you're in the area. As long as your dog leaves them alone, the dog should be fine. And if you know where the badgers are, certainly keep your dogs on a leash or keep them out of that pasture would be the safest thing. And if you have any other, if you want any more information or you need help trying to figure out how to manage the badgers, call your county Department of Natural Resource biologist, and they should be able to come out and consult with you and help you figure out the best solution for your property.
Okay, great idea. And how fun, though, to have badgers in your yard. Let's go back to the phones. We've got a bunch of calls here, and Lynn in Boulder Junction is up next. Hi, Lynn. Oh, Lynn, are you there? Oh, I think we lost Lynn. Well, let's just go to Jerome in Hillsboro then. Hi, Jerome.
Yeah, hello. Is there a quick way of identifying the difference between a pickerel frog and a leopard frog?
Well, how quick? those are two true frog species. They're typically associated with more deep water or, like a lake that's a little bit deeper than just a shallow pond. So the pickerel frog, typically, if you look on the backside of them, they will have paired spots, and the spots tend to be more rectangular. And so they'll be kind of in a symmetrical line down the back, not true symmetry, but they'll be more paired. The leopard frog has more rounded spots, and again, it's not a pure circle. It's more roundish. And the spots tend to be more randomly placed on the leopard frog's back. The other thing, if you can catch the frogs and you have them in hand, if you flip them over, the pickerel frog will have a bright yellow groin and inner thigh, and the leopard frog will not.
Okay.
And then obviously you can distinguish the two of them between the call as well if you want.
Do you want to tell us what those calls are, David?
yes, let me see. The call of the pickerel frog is more like a snore.
Okay.
Sort of like that. And the call of the leopard frog is as if you were taking your finger and rubbing it across a wet balloon.
Oh, okay. Excellent. I like that. Okay. Thank you, Jerome. We appreciate your call. Now let's go to Happy in Oconomowoc. Hi, Happy.
Hi. Well, I've got a problem with at least one pair of red-winged blackbirds, first time I've seen them around here, and I know they're nesting, at least one nest, and I can't get down to my garden to do anything because they get really angry. They are very aggressive. And have you got any idea how I can protect myself?
Yeah. It's kind of like the bully who wants your lunch money as you walk to school, right?
Exactly.
So a couple of things, Happy. Red-winged blackbirds are a migratory species in the state of Wisconsin. They're one of the first birds that return. Obviously, they're primarily blackbird with red patches on their wings. That's why they get their name. And it is very likely that they do have a nest nearby. That's why they're being so aggressive. Now, if the nest does not have eggs or birds in it, you can destroy the nest legally, and that will alleviate some of this because they won't be tied to that nest and they won't be so protective of that area. If the nest has either eggs and or birds in it, without a federal permit, it is illegal to destroy that nest. You'll just have to live with it. So what you can do in the meantime is if you have a decent-sized hat with a wide brim all the way around, you can wear that. You can take an umbrella out there if you want and just walk through the area with the umbrella so that at least you have some protection to your head, and you can kind of fend the birds off with that umbrella if you want. The other thing is, even though they are aggressive and they're not happy you're going to be there, and they might swoop on you, they are not going to typically hit you or hurt you. So you can just kind of swat your hand around as they come by, and that should move them away from your body as you go. But I think the best thing if you're concerned about it, and it's more of an annoyance than anything else, but just have an open umbrella as you walk out to your garden.
Well, that seems like a good idea. But how much longer will they be nesting?
So those birds probably have a two-week incubation period, and then the birds probably will stay in the nest for another week or so.
All right.
So, probably by the end of June for sure.
Okay.
At the latest, I would think they'd be done.
Okay, well, good luck with that, Happy. And if you're going to go out there, you should probably videotape it so that we can watch. Next up, Tenzin in Athens. Hi, Tenzin.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a piece of ground that I'm trying to manage by just mowing once or twice a year. It's fallow ground right now. And I've noticed a lot of nesting birds and other critters in there. And I'm wondering, what's the earliest I can get in there to mow without doing unnecessary disruption to whatever's trying to hang out in there?
Is it a grassland or a pasture type field?
Yeah, it's kind of a grassy pasture prairie thing. But I'm going to put it into permaculture and sometime in the next coming years.
Okay. And do you need to get the grass or the hay off of that to feed animals for any particular reason?
Nope. Okay. We're just cutting it and letting it lay just as a way to promote growth, to create more biomass in the soil, okay, and also manage certain late season weeds.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. Well, if you can delay any mowing until at least after July 15th, that would be the best. And then those birds that are in there, even if they're on their second or possibly third nest, at least they've gotten one successful nest to reproduce, and that will help the population. So if you can wait until July 15th, that would be great. And a lot of people also might have a flushing bar that they put on their mower. So the flushing bar is just in front of the mower and actually goes right along kind of the ground level. So any animal, bird or otherwise that is in that area, when that flushing bar comes along, they get out of the way of the mower, and they don't typically get hit by the mower. So you could investigate putting something like that on your mower if you want to as well.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that call, Tenzin. It's a great question. Next, we're going to talk to Ralph in Eau Claire and Russ County. Hi, Ralph.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess it is
yes,
now.
Yes, it is afternoon.
my question is bluebirds. I actually live in Eau Claire, but I have property in Russ County, and I have not seen a bluebird at either place. And normally I do see them every spring. Even in Eau Claire, I have nesting in my backyard.
Huh, yeah.
So I don't know, maybe the late spring held them up somewhere, so I decided to stay there and nest in the heck with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, they should be up here, and I've seen them up where I live pretty regularly. So, you know, and we had a pretty good migration year this year where a lot of birds came up and all at one time and things of that nature. So they should be around. And it might be, again, one of those things where they may not be where they normally are because there's a different food source, or maybe somebody's been using some pesticide in the area and there's just not insects available for them, or maybe, you know, there's more cavity trees and they're a cavity nester. Maybe there's some natural nesting areas where they don't have to use bluebird boxes. You know, I mean, there could be a number of things going on. One thing you might want to do is go on, you can Google Wisconsin, then eBird, E-B-I-R-D, and you can search the eBird site based on location and see if people are reporting bluebirds in your area. And at least that would give you an indication as to whether other people are seeing them or not.
And that's another good place for people to report.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about
yeah,
was
absolutely.
eBirds.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. And thank you, Ralph. Next up is Lee in Green Bay. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, I just like David's thoughts on the use of, especially with the farmers, the use of Roundup and these lawn services with the other pesticides, the herbicides, whatever they're using in the environment. I don't see any of my green frogs anymore. I've got on my property here, I've got a pond that's about 3/4 of an acre. I don't even see any of the green frogs this year. After a rain, I always used to see, especially at night on a warm blacktop, you'd see the leopard frogs hopping across the road. I don't see that anymore. I think that's the use of these chemicals has contributed to the demise of a lot of our reptiles and amphibians and other wildlife.
Yeah, Lee, I guess I'm a little reluctant to put all the blame on Roundup or some of these other herbicides out there. You know, people who are applying that as a lawn service or farmers, you know, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt that they're doing this ethically and responsibly and legally, and they're following what's called the manufacturer recommended guidelines on the back of the label of the bottle and things like that. And certainly Roundup or glyphosate is what the active ingredient in Roundup is. And, you know, that is not intended for water. So where people are applying that near water, you know, hopefully they're doing it correctly. But again, you know, there are a whole host of issues going on with the reptiles and amphibians out there, green frogs in particular, and some other species, where, you know, loss of wetland habitat, if there's a new road built, you know, sometimes they get hit and killed on the road, and there's a variety of other things going on. So I guess I'm a little reluctant to put it solidly on Roundup and not some other things without more information or more data collected. But yeah, so whatever you can do on your property to manage for your wetland and protect the amphibians using the wetland, every little bit helps.
Okay, thank you very much, Lee. We do have some open lines. If you've got a question for David about wildlife or you've got a comment or observation, our number, 1-800-642-1234. Next up, we've got Mark from Rhodes. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
You had a question about snapping turtles, but we have already covered it. But
You did? Okay.
Yeah, but David, why don't you quickly tell people again?
Yep. Okay. So, Mark, again, snapping turtles are deceptively quick, especially around the head area. So make sure you keep your fingers and anything else away from the head and the mouth. The best thing is if you can avoid touching or picking up the snapping turtle altogether, that's the best thing for you, and it's probably the best thing for the snapping turtle. So if you can kind of move it along with a stick or kind of gently prod it or push it from behind with your foot or something like that, that would be great. But if you do have to pick the animal up, please avoid picking it up by the back legs or the tail, and instead put one hand on the top of the shell right behind the head and one hand on top of the shell right in front of the tail and lift it up that way and then move it and then gently place it down.
Okay, and Mark, you did have another question, correct?
Yes. What I've been doing with the snapping turtles is grabbing the tail and then putting my hand underneath. First of all, pushing on the top of the shell to immobilize it, grabbing the tail, and then putting my hand underneath, keeping the snapping turtle horizontal and lifting it up and moving it across.
Yeah, you know, whatever you can do to keep yourself safe. And the only issue with doing something like that is, you know, some of those larger animals are heavy, and as they start moving around, they could easily slip out of your hand. And if they fall from, three or four feet up, you know, they could crack their shell and things like that. Being able to grab it, solidly at the top of the shell, front and back, you just have a better control of that animal.
I saw a spectacle in near around Monroe, Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, of chimney swifts. I was visiting a friend, and in the morning they would leave the chimney, and in the evening they would come in. And there must have been 100 or 200 of these birds going down the chimney, like a tornado of birds. I'd never seen that before in my life.
Yeah, well, they're called chimney swifts for a reason, and they are a swift. A very swift flying bird. They're like a swallow, so they feed on what's called on the wing. They are insect eaters, and that's what they're doing through the sky, and you'll hear them chattering over the course of the day. And the best description of a chimney swift is it's a cigar with wings, is what it literally looks like. Their body looks like a cigar with wings, and they are super fun birds to watch. They are very common in cities because they inhabit these tall industrial smokestacks, but they also inhabit, if you don't have a chimney cap on your house, they will also inhabit the chimney of your house. Super neat birds. They're great to have around because they're fun to watch, but they also eat a lot of insects, mosquitoes included.
Okay, thanks so much, Mark. Next, we'll have Amanda in Pigeon Falls. Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Earlier this spring, there was a flock of Canada geese that came through our town, Pigeon Falls, and they would stay on the pond. And there was one snow goose that was with the flock. Is that common, or is there a possibility that it was a different morph of a Canada goose? Are they ever all white? It was just an interesting thing that happened.
Yeah, typically Canada geese typically don't have much of a color variation. They're that typical gray with black and black long black neck. So the white goose you could have seen, it very well could have been a snow goose. Could have been a resident flock of Canada geese that were not migrating anywhere. They were just flying to a different area in that location. And it might have been a white generic farm goose that was in with them as well. So I'm not sure. It is not uncommon for a variety of waterfowl species to migrate together.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about wildlife with David Drake, a professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. I'd like to thank Dave Potras for technical direction and Jane Rotunda for on-air production. Hope you can join us tomorrow. Our consumer protection specialist will be back to tell us about the latest scams and help you with your consumer problems. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I've been sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us because there's always more to come.